Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden, and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 6 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we unpacked Claudio Ranieri's latest footballing miracle. We explored the German city of Köln's passionate footballing landscape. We discussed Jude Bellingham's relentless headline making, and we put a special teenage talent lighting up Ligue 1 under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you learn a thing or two, or perhaps even three. Hope you're all staying safe. Hope you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Well, we are recording on Halloween, so hopefully there won't be any shock scares over the course of the episode. Rudy Barlow is looking rather chilly, actually, in Madrid. He was me thinking that Barlow was going to be roasting all year round. No, I'm not that naive, but it felt at one point, certainly for Barlow anyway, that it was going to be an eternal summer. But yes, it is cold in Madrid now. It's fairly cold as well in the south side of Glasgow, and I'm pretty sure it'll be rather chilly in Manchester. We'll be joined in due course by Michael Jones. But in the meantime, Rudy Barlow, how are you doing?
Yeah, I should say it's not a filter that I've got on here. It is just, it's that kind of dark and kind of pale light. It does feel like the colour's been kind of removed, and summer is so far in the past, when just 2 weeks ago it felt pretty warm, it has to be said. But enough chat about the weather, and we've got plenty of football to keep us warm, don't we, Ali?
Yeah, Barlow, absolutely. It has been a fantastic couple of weeks in the Bundesliga. It's been a fantastic couple of weeks across Europe as well, you could say, and we're going to discuss all of that in our usual way over the next 60 minutes or so. Say 60 minutes, but we very rarely stick to 60 minutes. I seem to remember that was the golden rule back in the first and second series, that we would never cross the dreaded hour mark, but we've been doing that with increasing frequency of late. So I can only apologise to you, the listener, or perhaps you, the listener, enjoy listening to our dulcet tones for that little bit longer. But yeah, Barlow, let's get started with the Bundesliga.
Yeah, well, in your previous episode, Ali, we mentioned that we put kind of Bo Svensson's struggling Mainside under the Road to Nowhere in microscope. 200 kilometres or so to the northwest of Mainz, Stefan Baumgart's Köln have also endured a dreadful start to the new campaign. Quite alarmingly, heading into the recent international break, they had picked up just 1 point from an available 21 and therefore found themselves rooted to the bottom of the Bundesliga table after 7 match days. They did, however, pick up a vital 3-1 victory over fellow strugglers Borussia Mönchengladbach in the most recent edition of the Rhine Derby. With all that in mind, how might we assess Köln's chances of building on that fiery win over Gladbach and bouncing back from a subsequent 6-0 loss away to RB Leipzig, and ultimately avoiding a first relegation to the second tier of German football since 2018.
Yeah, Barlow, that win over Gladbach was really special. The atmosphere at the Rhein Energy Stadion before, during, and yeah, after the match really served as a reminder, if we ever needed one, that the Bundesliga is a better place, a much better place at that, when Köln are in it. Similar in a way to how Nantes and their fans bring real value to Ligue 1 in France. Now, Archie Rintoult shared a great clip on social media of the Köln players and the Köln ultras singing together after the Gladbach game with the PA system music turned off so that those voices were all you could hear. And it really was one of those moments, Barlow, that would make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And I don't say that lightly. It was a fantastic moment, really atmospheric. But as good as that was, as good as the Derby win on the whole was, the outlook is still rather bleak, Barlow, and relegation does still look like a real possibility for Kiln. Now, you can obviously only beat what is in front of you, but we do have to note that Gladbach really were woeful that Sunday during the Derby, and a lot of the Gladbach support had headed for the exits before the full-time whistle, and the Ultras made their feelings quite clear at the final whistle. So on the one hand, yeah, you've got the fact that Gladbach really weren't great, and also over and above that, you've got the fact that, yeah, as you alluded to, Barlow Köln were then thumped 6-0 by Leipzig the following week. So the derby joy was rather short-lived, and that derby joy did come with its caveats, I suppose. Not that we want to take too much away from what I'm sure was a brilliant day for the Köln fans. Anyway, before we unpack the reasons behind Köln's recent struggles, I do think it is worth just taking a step back to provide some local context. Now, friend of the podcast, Byron Hutchison, lives in Köln, and so I've spoken to him about the club several times now, and one thing he said to me really stands out, and that's the fact that Köln are probably more under the microscope in the city of Köln than Rangers or Celtic would be in Glasgow or in Scotland on the whole. Over 1 million people live in Köln, and with very few exceptions, almost everybody in the city supports the club. So it would be very rare to see somebody in the city wearing a Bayern Munich top, for example, which anecdotally anyway, contrasts quite starkly with a lot of the French cities, for example, where you would see plenty of PSG tops or even more historically, Marseille tops. All of that does naturally put pressure on the team to perform, and it's all well and good when you can harness the city-wide momentum when things are going well and you're picking up results. But when you're on the sort of run that Köln are on right now with just one win in their opening 9 league games, that pressure can really exacerbate what is an already difficult situation. This time, a couple of seasons ago, we were waxing poetic about Köln's effective blend of physicality and technicality. They were playing, yeah, this fast-paced and attractive style of counter-attacking football under Baumgarten. At that point, they sat top in the Bundesliga for intensive runs, third for sprints, fourth for duels won, third for aerials won, and third for fouls committed. Now, Baumgarten himself is a very passionate manager. He wears his heart on his sleeve. He's very rough and tumble, you might say. And for his intense brand of football to work, you really need 100% buy-in from your players, or else it can all quite rapidly fall apart at the seams. Fast forward to November 2023, and although it maybe hasn't quite fallen apart at the seams, it is clear, Barlow, that something isn't quite right at the Rhein Energy Stadium. I spoke about the need for buy-in with a system as intense as Baumgart's, and I don't think anybody who watched the Rhein Derby, certainly in isolation anyway, I don't think anybody who watched that game would even begin to suggest that the players are not on board with what Baumgart is trying to do. Looking at the numbers since the start of the season, they sit second in the league for intensive runs and fourth for distance covered. So, yeah, the effort is absolutely there. Perhaps tellingly, however, they are down in 14th for duels won and 14th for aerials won. And perhaps you could say, Barlow, that those statistics are maybe more outcome-based than how far you're running or how intense your running is. Quite simply, anyway, Barlow, the main issue is that the playing squad is now sorely lacking in the quality it once had. So since that brilliant campaign we spoke about a couple of years ago, they've lost the likes of Anthony Modeste and Sari Özcan in 2022. Then this summer, Erye Shkiri joined Frankfurt on a free, and yeah, club icon Jonas Hector retired. Özcan and Shkiri were so pivotal to that success as a midfield pair in the 2021-2022 campaign, and it is also almost impossible, I think, Barlow, to overstate Hector's value as the club's captain, as a real leader, and yeah, as a very good footballer. So what we are seeing now really shouldn't be too surprising. The one silver lining for Köln is that they still have the 31-year-old Florian Kainz on their books. He scored twice in the derby win against Gladbach, with both of his goals coming from the penalty spot. He's made well over 100 appearances for the club, and he took on the role of club captain following Jonas Hector's retirement. Now, he's a player of real quality, arguably the player with the most quality in the whole Kiln squad, typically operating as an attacking midfielder. But we do also occasionally see him playing in a deeper role or out wide. Regardless, he is so important to this Kiln side, and you do think that he will necessarily play a key role in this bid to beat the drop. Elsewhere, 27-year-old Luca Waldschmidt could be a real difference maker in the final third. Now, we should emphasise the word could, because he's not really hit the ground running since joining from Wolfsburg on loan this summer. It was quite remarkable, only 3 years since we were talking about him picking up caps for the German national side, and Benfica were forking out €15 million to sign him from Freiburg. But since then, there is, and quite justifiably, there is this feeling that he's maybe lost his way somewhat. That said, he showed glimpses of what he can do in the win over Gladbach. So the question now, I suppose, is whether he can build on that, just like Kiln on the whole, and find some consistency. On a closing note, I do just want to mention Kiln's iconic mascot, Hennis the Goat. Now, I should clarify that Hennis is a living goat rather than just somebody in a costume, and he's something of a German football institution. The first Hennis was presented to the club as a lucky charm by a circus director during Carnival back in 1950. So the club soon picked up their famous Billy Goat's nickname, and Hennis soon made his way onto the club's badge. So yeah, Hennis, he's an icon in Kiln and beyond, and there's no shortage of great Hennis stories, as I'm sure you can imagine, Barlow. So in 2017, for example, the club tried to register Hennis the Eighth as a player when they were struggling with injuries. And there's a great photo and also a great video from earlier this season when Hennis the Ninth made a break for it onto the pitch whilst the players were warming up. So he drags a handler across the pitch, and a few of the players, when they realise what's happening, there's a great look on some of their faces. So do go and have a look at that footage. Or there's a particular photo as well that I'm thinking of, which just captures the moment brilliantly. Elsewhere, yeah, back in 2015, maybe not quite as positive or enjoyable a story this, but Anthony Udja took things a little bit too far when he tried to celebrate a goal by grabbing Hennis the Eighth by the horns and trying to climb on top of him like a donkey almost. As an aside, perhaps unsurprisingly, Anthony Udja was later sold that summer. But yeah, anyway, if you want to go and find out more about Hennis the Goat, and why wouldn't you, Barlow, I suppose, is the question to be asked, then do go and check out the official Bundesliga's very enjoyable article on him. Being serious, again, I am quite pessimistic about Kiln's chances this season. But for Hennis the Goat's sake, for the sake of the city as a whole, and even for the sake of the Bundesliga, I do hope the club can prove me wrong. Okay, we're going to park our chat about Kiln there. We're going to turn our attention to Spanish football. We've just had El Clásico, a brilliant Clásico at that, and Rudy Barlow is going to talk us through how that unfolded and the wider significance of the final result. We'll be right back. El Clásico took place at the weekend for anyone living under a rock, and Jude Bellingham stole the headlines once again with an incredible brace to snatch the game for Real Madrid. Clearly, there is delight in the Spanish capital, satisfaction at seeing them 4 points above their rivals, and you too will have to eulogise about Bellingham. But why is Carlo Ancelotti coming in for criticism still? And yeah, on the whole, what do we make of Real Madrid, Barlow?
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating because, yeah, I'm going to declare Jude Bellingham is the best player in the world right now. There's nobody that's really scoring more goals. Harry Kane's kind of up there. He's about around the same goals. He's got a few more assists. But Bellingham's capacity to come up with these goals in crucial moments, and in particular in El Clásico, there's no bigger demonstration of that. The fact that regardless of how he seems to be playing, and in this game, you could argue he maybe had his poorest performance of his Real Madrid career, except for the fact that he scored these two goals from absolutely nowhere. I mean, Real Madrid, I think they caused one good save from Marc-Andre ter Stegen from a shot from distance from Tchouaméni, which was flying, to be fair. But apart from that, there's really no chances to speak of. And about 60 minutes, 67 minutes in, I think the goal goes in. Real Madrid had started to play in the right areas, but we're still struggling to kind of break Barcelona down, who were comfortable. They defended this match well, and Bellingham thumps one into the top corner, absolute arrow. I mean, Sid Lowe's been describing it as kind of a sawed-off goal, as a kind of frustration. And as speaking to, not to do too much of a name drop, but I was speaking to Michael Owen the other day about Bellingham, and I was talking, I was asking him, so how is it that you're 20 years old, you come into Real Madrid, the biggest club in the world, and you just don't feel the pressure, or you find a way past that? And he was saying that essentially this is just Jude Bellingham's day job. I mean, he comes in, he's highly capable of what he's asked to be, what he's being asked to do. And it's only when that you're not under pressure to do something that you're not comfortable with, that's when pressure really starts to get to you. So he was saying that Bellingham probably feels the same pressure as anybody else going into a meeting or just kind of going about their day job, essentially, which I found interesting. But you could kind of see the frustration building in Bellingham for that sort of shot, as Sid Lowe described it. And yeah, not many of us have the ability or the social setting to thump something when we're frustrated at work, quite like Jude Bellingham did. But yeah, he pops up with a goal in stoppage time again. And it has to be said that Barcelona probably deserves a point, if not more. If you had to pick one winner in this game, it was probably Barcelona. But Bellingham is... There's two kind of... contrasting thoughts in my mind here, because on the one side, Carlo Ancelotti is coming in for criticism for this, because look, I mean, yeah, they were dominated by a Barcelona side for about 50-60 minutes that is missing four or five of their best players. They really struggled to create anything. Some of their best players are not performing, and yet Carlo Ancelotti is also the one responsible, the one that saw this in Bellingham, that he could be this kind of forward that gets in the box. And I don't think neither Bellingham nor Ancelotti expected it to be this much of an impact, but he was the one that saw this potential in Bellingham. And without a striker, okay, yes, he had to get inventive as well. He's got a lot of midfielders, but he's the one that's built this side around Jude Bellingham. He's rebuilt this Real Madrid side around Jude Bellingham rather than Vinicius Jr., for example. And so he deserves credit from that. But on the other hand, look at this Real Madrid team. So Rodrigo's got two goals. Vinicius Jr., okay, he had an injury for the month and he's not playing terribly, but he's got three goals. He doesn't quite look as comfortable. Luka Modric is out at the side. Toni Kroos really struggled against Fermin Lopez for the first kind of half of this game. 20-year-old Barcelona midfielder who's just, yeah, turning things up. I'll come on to him. But yeah, Toni Kroos struggled in this game. Aurelien Tchouaméni is now out with a metatarsal injury, but he's not been consistent either. I mean, you look at the defence, and David Alaba's probably having his worst season in Real Madrid colours so far, his worst season in quite some time, I would say, in fact. And Fede Valverde's been pretty good. But you look across this Real Madrid side, and what is the job of the manager? The job of the manager is to purpose your players and get the best out of them. So Dani Carvajal has been absolutely outstanding. For me, the second most decisive player in this Real Madrid side, apart from Bellingham. And yeah, he made a crucial challenge at the weekend on Joao Felix, really goal-saving stuff. And apart from Carvajal, apart from Bellingham, how many of these players are really at their best or performing really well? Not that many. So yeah, on that, from that point of view, Real Madrid aren't controlling big games. I mean, they lost to Atleti 3-1 and they looked pretty vulnerable there. Their players, their best players are not, he's not getting the best out of them. And yet they still are top of the league and they still find a way to win these games through Bellingham. So the responsibility that he's taken on, the move to put Bellingham into that position is really praiseworthy. And yet at the same time, Hossellou has got the same amount of goals combined as Vinicius and Rodrigo. And for me, Hossellou should be starting ahead of Rodrigo, because I think even if he does perhaps occupy some of the areas that Bellingham would get into in the box, I think Hossellou also drags defenders away from Bellingham at times. And you see in the goal, when Modric miscontrols it, he's kind of in that channel between the fullback and the central defender. And if Modric wasn't there, I mean, Hossellou probably would have been there. That's probably the position he would have been in. So yeah, I think for me, it's a dysfunctional team right now. And I'll cast back to last season when we thought Benzema's not quite fit, but when he gets fit, they'll be better. Vinicius is taking on a lot of responsibility. Valverde is scoring all of these goals. Real Madrid are not perfect, but they will come good. There's so much room for improvement. And again, you can look at it glass half full or glass half empty. Last season, we didn't see that improvement in the second half of the season, although I think they were ever so slightly better in terms of how they played football, but less effective in that second half of the season. And there's no World Cup to deal with this time, so that's obviously a help, not a hindrance for Ancelotti. But there's plenty of work to do, and yeah, if Real Madrid continue to play like this, it's a lot of pressure to put on Bellingham to keep coming up with these results, with these goals. And so far, I think it's 13 in 13 games. If he does sustain that, then we're looking at the next Messi or Ronaldo.
Yeah, interesting times indeed for Jude Bellingham and Real Madrid. Now, Barcelona are in something of a strange position themselves. They are obviously behind in the title race, struggling with injuries, and yet come Monday morning, a significant portion of Sport and Mundo Deportivo were positive about matters in Catalonia. That was in stark contrast to Ilkay Gundogan, who called out his teammates for a lack of passion in their classical defeat. What are Gundogan's comments getting at, and where are Barcelona going, Barlow?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, Gundogan's comments, because he came out and said I didn't come here to lose these games, and that people need to take this more seriously, and that, yeah, we need more passion in these defeats. He also kind of answered his own question in the fact that he said, well, I'm one of the veterans too, and it's up to me to kind of set that tone, and this is a young Barcelona side. I'd say you've got a side with Gavi and Ronald Araujo in it. I don't think it's necessarily lacking in passion. And in particular, this defeat, the manner it came in, the fact that they'd played probably a little bit better than Real Madrid without being outstanding. I do want to highlight that. They weren't world beaters or anything, but they were edging the game. The manner that this came in and the kind of impotency against this kind of Bellingham brace that came from absolutely nowhere, I think it kind of put Barcelona in a state of shock as much as anything, because Barcelona played badly and lost a lot of big games in the last 5 years. But when they play well, they tend to generally get results. And so I think it's a bit of a sensitive issue in Barcelona, who for 4 or 5 years, especially after those kind of European debacles, were always especially sensitive to collapsing in a game, or even if they would lose kind of a game narrowly against a big team, it would always be put down to their mental strength. This side doesn't have it. This side doesn't have that grit. And last season, I think we did see that, because we saw them win 3 out of 5 Clásicos against Real Madrid. Two of them, they were really undermanned for, and they kind of ground out results. They were defending in their box at the Bernabeu for one of them. And I don't think it's necessarily a problem of passion, although obviously Gundogan will know better than me and he can set the standard. I think for me, the big question we have to ask about this Barcelona side is one that we raised earlier. They've got 19 first team players. Okay, you had Lamine Yamal, who probably isn't a 90-minute player. He's 60, 70 minutes a game if you can. He's only 16, of course. Fermin Lopez looks like he has enough in him to be going for 80, 90 minutes. He's still only 20, though. So you've got about 21 players. And one of the things that Xavi was so, for want of a better word, anal about last season was, we need all of these positions doubled up. We need 2 players for every position. We need to be able to rotate. And they don't have that right now. And Oriol Romeu is their only real kind of pivot option. So you introduce him in this game and he's pretty sloppy, to be honest. And despite his really good start, as we mentioned, he's kind of fallen off quite a lot. And so you have all these players that are quite good. You don't quite know what your best team is. And they're definitely going towards a more attacking style, more creative players. Joao Felix, Cancelo, Fermin Lopez, they've given them much more of a goal threat. And when it comes to breaking teams down, I think they have plenty more. But the way that that's manifested itself is defensively, it's causing them issues. And where is it causing them the most issues? For me, pressing. And you saw that in the Clásico, is that for 60 minutes, Barcelona really kind of, yeah, edged this game. They made it difficult for Real Madrid to get out. They made it difficult for Real Madrid to advance. And
while not always having the ball, were always kind of more or less in control of this match. And yet they kind of fell off quite a lot in that last half hour. And so if you have a side, a squad that's that short, and we're dealing with a lot of injuries right now as well, and probably going to deal with injuries down the line in that second half of the season, can you get the side to press for 70, 80 minutes? You're not going to be able to do it the whole game, but can you get the side to press sufficiently long enough in these big games to come out with results? And indeed, against those smaller sides, when you need to be sharp in the first 15, 20 minutes, you saw against Granada, they went down early. You saw against Mallorca that they went down as well. Can you be sharp enough? Can you get enough kind of burst and kind of zip out of this team in order to make this system function? So yeah, I think for me, that's the really big question. And this is, again, similarly, a Barcelona side that I think plays better football than last season, but perhaps less effective right now. And so Xavi needs to work out where those adjustments and where the compromise is going to have to come from.
Girona are the story of the season this year, sitting pretty at the top of the table alongside Real Madrid. But there's one player in particular who continues to excel and orchestrate this Girona side more than anyone else. Now, you have a rather bold claim to make, Barlow.
Yeah, if you'll allow me to have Bellingham as a forward, because he does kind of tend to roam around pretty freely. Aleix Garcia is the best midfielder in La Liga. I mean, he was incredible last season. He's been adapting to a new role. He has essentially replaced Uriel Romeu in that kind of deepest holding role. Sometimes he has Yangel Herrera alongside him, but he's operating at an incredibly high level right now. And as I say, he's that deepest midfielder, but he's also the most creative in La Liga right now. He's in real time diagnosing holes in the defense. He's working out kind of potential avenues of advancement. He is the director of this orchestra for Michel Sanchez. And while he tends to move forward, and you saw that against Celta Vigo, 92nd minute, he comes up with a kind of back heel flick assist for Yangel Herrera running onto it, kind of outside the box. And so he's doing that without leaving Girona too vulnerable on the counter. And they were a little bit lucky against Celta. But speaking kind of more generally, and I saw him in action live at Cadiz as well, where he comes up with the crucial goal. He just kind of whips it in. And he's really kind of leading this side. That you saw him kind of giving out, perhaps I thought harshly sometimes, giving out a bit to Giancalto, giving out to Savio as to when they took the wrong decisions, and really kind of driving his team forward and ensuring that it's his decision kind of where they attack almost, along with Michel, of course, I'm sure, but he is the one that's kind of implanting that message on the pitch. And in terms of the stats, I mean, I was pleased to look at his FBref page and find that everything I'm saying is completely backed up. Second for assists with 4. He's 4th for key passes with 25. He's top for progressive passes with 88. He's 2nd for shot creating actions. That's 5th in the big 5 leagues in total. He's averaging a pass that ends in a goal per game. That's 11. So we're talking a lot of goal creating actions or goal creating passes. And he's top for passes in the final third. He's also top for goal creating actions. And he's played every minute of the season so far for Girona. And granted, they're not in Europe. They don't have that midweek strain. But yeah, Aleix Garcia for me has to be in the next Spain squad. If it's non-negotiable, because even if you've got the likes of kind of Fabian Ruiz, who's big, he's physical, he gets into the box, he covers a lot of ground, he's kind of quite a versatile midfielder that managers quite like, Aleix Garcia is playing at such a high level right now that, I mean, you obviously have to see how he looks out with this Girona system. But for me right now, he's playing at a level where you could just stick him in any team, and regardless of kind of what's going on around him, he will solve the problems. So yeah, tune into Aleix Garcia, because it's an absolute kind of, it's a fun show to watch right now.
Yeah, we do enjoy a deep-lying orchestrator on the Road to Nowhere podcast. So yeah, I'll be sure to watch out for his performances over the rest of the season. Okay, we are going to take a short break now. Michael Jones is going to join us shortly, and he's going to tell us all about the latest goings-on in Italy. We'll be right back. in a weekend of tantalising matchups in Italy's top flight. One of the lower scoring affairs saw Inter Milan defeat AS Roma 1-0 thanks to a late strike from Marcus Thuram. For all the Frenchman's form, much of the pre-match discourse had focused on the man Thuram had replaced, a certain Romelu Lukaku, upon his return to the San Siro. With the Derby de la Capitale on the horizon in a couple of match days, what have we made of Lukaku's stint in Rome so far and I Giallo Rossi as a collective, Michael?
Yeah, well, that discourse has been certainly under the magnoscope of everybody in Italy, really, ahead of that return to Inter Milan at the weekend. We've seen some pretty crazy things since covering the podcast from afar, but this might have just been the craziest one yet, ahead of the game, the Inter Milan media and the club staff refused to do some of the pre-match coverage because they didn't want to inflame anything before the game. And that was because differing figures between 30,000 and 40,000 fans from the Nerazzurri ultras were planning to bring whistles in to whistle at Lukaku, which I've never heard of on that scale at all before. Like actual whistles. I know fans whistle, but actual whistles being brought in. And yeah, the stewards, well, I think some of them probably did their best. Some of them maybe didn't do their best to stop those whistles getting in. But a lot of them, maybe not 30,000, but a good few thousand, I suspect, got in. And yeah, the reception was toxic, to say the least. But I'd really recommend anybody just tuning in to any sort of clip you can find of it online. And yeah, that was maybe the biggest takeaway from Lukaku's evening back in Milan, which is probably, you know, not to summarize his whole spell at the club. I think he's a top league scorer with 5 goals. He scored a few in Europe in recent games with Slavia Prague. That performance stands out in particular. But yeah, I mean, there's different elements. I think Romelu Lukaku is probably one of the most complex figures to analyse in world football. I think he can be an extremely polarising person and footballer. I think that you can find a lot of content interviews with him where he's come across as an extremely intelligent, graceful person. I don't think there's really any questions about his sort of intelligence. He's really, you know, speaks so many languages as well. But I think some of his actions have left a lot to be desired, whether that be in Italy or England, where he's obviously spent the bulk of his career. And I think, you know, the whole tension stemmed from him having that option to return to Inter Milan, you know, laid out in front of him, presented what appeared to be good terms and just ignoring them, basically, until that fell through. And then eventually, after training on his own at Chelsea for a while, made the move to Roma. But yeah, we spoke about Roma going into the season, big season for them, big season for Jose Mourinho. He's in the last season of his contract. In Europe, at least, it's all gone very smoothly so far. They are top of their group. But domestically, it's been quite mixed. They were around the relegation zone after August. They had a good response generally in September. And then for the bulk of this month, they'd gone undefeated. They'd suffered a huge defeat to Genoa at the end of September when they lost 4-1. And then they'd gone undefeated since then before losing here to Inter Milan. But I think the problem with Roma's performance against Inter Milan was, you know, one of the reasons why I'm not very excited. And with Lazio, you know, you mentioned those exciting fixtures. Lazio defeated, got a really impressive victory at the weekend over Fiorentina. So I think they're certainly the ones who also made a slow start by coming into this derby with more momentum. But we'll touch on that a lot more on the next episode, I think. But yeah, I just think Roma, they didn't play that game to win. I listened to a podcast, one of the Roma press I always do before covering Roma, because really insightful and passionate fans who cover that. And, you know, they were saying, which I completely agreed with, and the analysis of Daniel Adani, former Serie A player, they just didn't play to win, whereas Inter Milan did. And Inter Milan hit the woodwork three times. Roma had one chance in the whole game, really, that resulted from a huge up and under that was just launched into the box, and it was a towering header from Cristante Foster, really good save, in fact, from Jan Sommer, but that was the only real chance of no. And even the goal itself, there was just such a lack of intensity. And the way they play, it was reminiscent at times, I think, in that game versus Sevilla in the final, albeit with a bit more intensity. But I think sometimes watching Mourinho teams in the latter part of his career, you know that they're not going to have as much possession, but they just don't have that intensity to win the ball back that they once did. And that, they just remind me of sort of that. I remember Steve Sidwell talking about Fulham under Felix Magath, when he took them into a training session, 11 players without a ball, and just made them stand in position for 45 minutes or something and didn't move. Roma do that. They do move, but they don't move out of position very far at times. And there's a real lack of press, real lack of energy and cohesion. And I think there's a bit of a fit between them and Lukaku, where, you know, Lukaku's goals have generally come against teams in the bottom half of the table this season. You know, maybe most of note was their 7-0 victory over Empoli back in September, where I think that was the first goal that he scored upon his return. And I think that's maybe that's something that Roma have generally done as well. They've been flat track bullies, and they've not picked up many scalps really this season. And that's something that I think they need to be judged by, because that is what Mourinho and Lukaku, you know, that's the kind of reason that they've been brought in on big money, for their impact that they're meant to deliver. But so far, yeah, not disastrous. They're sort of scraping by in a C-, doing the bare minimum. But I think it's harder to say more than that. And, you know, we could see a real big turn up for the performance for the Derby della Capitale. We certainly hope so, for the sake of the neutral, in the sake of making it a better game. But yeah, I'm certainly more excited and more enthusiastic about what Lazio will be doing in a couple of weeks as opposed to Roma right now. But yeah, there have been a number of new additions. They've been suffered, you know, they are struggling a bit with injuries. Chris Smalling's out, so is Pellegrini, amongst a few others. So they've got that to contend with. Stefan El-Shaarawy has had a bit of an even greater renaissance this season. He's got a late winner versus Monza recently, which has been really good for them as well. But yeah, I think generally, there's as always with Mourinho and Roma, I think there's been a lot left to be desired.
Oh, Cora, colour me frightened on Halloween. Elsewhere, history was made in Italian football last weekend. For the first time ever, a team recovered from being 3 goals down after 70th minute to win. Even more miraculously, that team was until then winless Cagliari, who recovered to beat Frosinone 4-3 and defied just about all footballing logic. Yet, with football miracle, football comes miracles, and with footballing miracles comes Claudio Ranieri. Could this result serve as the catalyst for Cagliari to start picking up more points and avoid an immediate relegation back to Serie B, Michael?
Potentially. I think if they play teams who are prepared to hand them victories in the sense that Frosinone did, they've got a good chance. But that's probably a slight disservice for Cagliari, given the manner that they came back. I mean, the result obviously is phenomenal. 3-0 down at 72 minutes when the comeback began. Like you said, never been done in Serie A history. But the game was actually fantastic, but also dreadful. And and I know that's quite contradictory, but it was so chaotic that both teams were just creating chances for one another rather than them creating chances for themselves. The pace of the game was so excruciatingly slow at times that you could genuinely watch the game for a good 10 or 20 seconds and both teams would be, you know, there wouldn't be any pressure from either team on the ball, and they'd just wait for one sloppy pass, which would happen frequently because of the lack of intensity, and then the other team would capitalise. That's how Frosinone took the lead through Matteo Sulli, player I'd like to discuss in a few weeks. He's a really exciting young player. He scored the first two for Frosinone. And then, yeah, they took the lead shortly after half time through Marco Brescianini. But yeah, you know, Cagliari during that time had the chances to come back. They had a header cleared off the line. They had a penalty in the first half. Golden Eagle had his penalty ricochet off the outside of the post. And then, yeah, at 72 minutes cometh their man, as nobody says, but Claudio Ranieri. And it was brilliant. They got their first goal back through Gaetano Aristiano, a young player on loan from Inter Milan. He's been one of their bright sparks this season. But they were certainly spearheaded by a 25-year-old Congolese midfielder called Antoine Makumbu. He scored the second goal. Leonardo Pavletti then came on to score a brace in stoppage time, with Makumbu setting up the fourth goal. After that fourth goal, Pavletti then clears a ball with his foot, off the line in unorthodox fashion. Then Aristiano races down the pitch down the other end in the last break of play in the 19th or the 100th minute of the game, only for his square pass to be so terrible. Goes to the corner flag, plays for full time, which in many ways that sums up the chaotic nature of the game. And, you know, I think there is certainly a case to be held. Ranieri has done enough miraculous work over the years, whether it's the brilliant stuff he did with Leicester or the terrible work he did with Greece, for him, you know, to be given the credit of having the potential to turn Cagliari's fortunes around. We discussed Salernitana on the podcast last season. We've not really discussed Empoli, but we've also discussed Udinese so far. There are some really bad teams in Serie A so far this season. So there is certainly a chance that Cagliari will be able to pick up enough points to stay up. And traditionally, you know, they bounce back with Ranieri first time around. But they've generally been quite good survival experts in Serie A over the past decade or so prior to that relegation. And there are still a few players, you know, Golden Eagle, Nathan Nandez, who was once a really highly coveted player for them. He went off actually at halftime during this game. Jakub Jankto, though, we spoke glowingly on the podcast last year, you know, what a brave decision it was seeing him come out during his time at Getafe. He's starting to start games for Cagliari now as well. But yeah, they have certainly been hamstrung. The Gianluca Lapadula, their top scorer last season in Serie B, he had an ankle operation at the start of the season, so that's certainly been a setback, and goals have been quite hard to come by. But yeah, they maybe start to find a solution now, and if they can get the likes of Makumbu more influential on their attacks going forwards, and the fact that Pavletti hadn't scored before then and now has got a brace, the experienced striker, he's 34 years of age. Lapadula wasn't ready to feature but was an unused substitute during the game. They've also got Andrea Petagna, Shomurodov, so they have got good striking options who are quite fit to play Ranieri's system. But yeah, we'll have to see how they get on in the near future. The only other thing that may really impact them with Makumbu, with Ibrahim Sulemana, who didn't feature in the game, is they've got those two, and and one other player, just escaped me off the top of my head, who will be away for the Africa Cup of Nations in January. And that could have, especially Makumbu, could have a really big impact on them. But yeah, I'm not quite sure, given the nature of the game, just how ready they are for survival. But other teams around them are certainly going to give them a chance.
Interesting stuff. Torino also gained a vital 3 points last weekend with their 1-0 victory away to Lecce, ending a 5-game winless run. Under Ivan Juric, progress has been quite positively linear and enjoyable, an oath to the Serbians' desire for death metal football. This season, however, the compliments have been less forthcoming. Why has that been the case, Michael?
Yeah, well, the first one, which is the obvious one, is results haven't been very good. They've gone 5 games without a victory, like you'd said. Maybe a bigger reason, though, and what maybe provides some really important context to this, is that from the outset, Torino had a really big summer in terms of not necessarily financial outlay, but in terms of their recruitment and the players they were able to bring in. I think there was a real sense of excitement as to what they're able to achieve this season. You're right in saying that, you know, that progress has been pretty linear over the past 2 seasons. You know, when Juric took over, they were a team battling relegation. And in the last 2 seasons, he secured the upper mid-table finishes. But they secured the permanent arrivals of Ivan Ilic and Vlasic, both of which, to be fair, you know, there is a fair bit of financial outlay because they were both around 10 million euros. And the likes of Nemanja Radonjić, a player you'll be familiar with from his time at Marseille, Brandon Soppy's coming on loan, Duvan Zapata, probably a really big signing for them coming in on loan. But yeah, I think one of the problems is now is that they've maybe just got a slightly bloated squad. And what we've seen from Juric in the last few games is that they have really struggled for consistency in selection in performances. And they've really struggled for creativity in front of goal. They've not been, in the last six league games, they've not been involved in a game where both teams have scored. And when they have scored, apart from that game we talked about on the podcast a couple of weeks ago with a 3-0 victory over Salernitana, they'd only scored 8 goals other than that up until that point. That their goal recently certainly helps them. There are reasons for optimism with Torino, though. Apart from Atalanta, they've played all the traditional Seven Sisters now, albeit not too much success. They did pick up a draw with Roma, but the 4-1 defeat to AC Milan early in the season was in fact the only game they played where they did score when another team had scored in the game. So their sort of bounce back ability, one of my favourite footballing terms. I don't think that's been something you can credit them with this season either. But yeah, given the players they've got, I generally understand the recruitment. I think it's quite aligned with George's philosophy. But I think one thing George really has to understand is where best to utilise his players. Tomasi's been playing as either centre-back or central midfielder. Nikola Vlasic, central midfielder or a forward. But yeah, in this game, as opposed to all the other games, he used a 3-5-2 as opposed to a 3-4-3, which he'd used prior to that. And I think that was a system that probably suits the personnel he's got more, especially ones the likes of Duvan Zapata, Pietro Pellegrini, Antonio Sanabria, good striking options for them, but all of which have scored less than 3 goals this season. But yeah, it looks like that will link up a bit better. But yeah, Radonjić has probably been one of the bright spots this season. He's a leading goal scorer with 3 goals, similar to the impact Jose Brekalo had. I can't remember the last season, a couple seasons ago now, but yeah, he had a real resurgence under Juric at Torino. But I think what they do find quite interesting is, although they've got slightly better fixtures coming up in the sense that they're avoiding the really big teams, they've got some really eye-catching fixtures in the sense that they've got Sassuolo, Monza, Bologna in the next 3 league games, and you probably say those are the teams they'll be competing with most at the moment to establish themselves in the middle, you know, as the best of the rest, really, in the top flight in Italy. So yeah, some really interesting games to keep an eye on. I think they'll be out to frustrate at the moment. I think they seem to be playing a bit with damage limitation, and yeah, to see that death metal return, you certainly just want Juric to maybe just give a bit more responsibility and trust to his players to play with a little bit more freedom.
Yeah, interesting stuff, Michael. Definitely one that we enjoy hearing about, Ivan Juric. So yeah, grateful for that update. Okay, we are going to take a quick break now. We're going to turn our attention to France. And yeah, there's chat that there's a new Kylian Mbappe on the scene. We'll be right back.
In France, match day 9's Breton derby between Lorient and Rennes provided us with the perfect opportunity to assess both clubs and look at one of the brightest young talents in Ligue 1 right now, as you were just mentioning, Ali. But yeah, heading into that game, Lorient sat in the relegation playoff spot while Rennes found themselves in 9th place after an underwhelming start to the season. Against that backdrop, Lorient prevailed with a precious 2-1 victory at a rocking Stade de Moustoir. The towering 20-year-old defender Isaac Touré grabbed the headlines on that occasion with the winner, and he himself would be well worthy of our attention. Further up the park, however, there's a certain 17-year-old lighting up Lorient's attack and reportedly attracting interest from the likes of Barcelona and Real Madrid. Tell us more, Ali.
Yeah, Michael, Eli Junior Kroupi. Remember the name because he is a mercurial talent and he's really going places. He had been lighting up Lorient's front three since the start of the season, but it was his performance in the 3-3 draw away to Leon, poor old Leon, at the start of October that really caught the eye. He bagged two goals playing out on the left wing, with the first of those two strikes being a real beauty. So, Michael, I don't know if you've seen the goal, but he danced away from his man. He then knocked the ball in front of him ever so slightly and then curled a superb strike into the top corner from just outside the box. Really such a satisfying goal, and one you could watch over and over. His second goal in the Leon game wasn't quite as spectacular, shall we say, but it was still impressive, Michael, to see his intelligence of movement to time his run across his man and meet a low cross into the box with a cushioned effort past the goalkeeper. After the game, his teammate Timo Bakayoko described him as, quote, a phenomenon, unquote, saying that Eli Junior Kroupi reminds him a little of a certain Kylian Mbappe in terms of the maturity of his game at such a young age. So yeah, that is high praise indeed, that goes without saying, and you wouldn't want to put too much pressure on a player who only turned 17 in June, but every so often a player comes along and makes you think, this lad is, yeah, he's going to the very top. And that's the feeling that we get when we watch Eli Junior Kroupi. Quite ridiculously, he was born on the 23rd of June 2006, which, for some quite sobering context, you might not want to hear this, Michael, but that was the week before Portugal beat England on penalties in that fiery World Cup quarterfinal in Gelsenkirchen, and Wayne Rooney was infamously sent off. So
yeah, some, I remember it too so, well.
So quite sobering, I'm sure you do, Michael. Some quite sobering context. I think maybe I've just triggered some unhappy memories for some English listeners of the podcast. So yeah, turning our attention back to Eli Junior Kroupi, he scored three goals and he's provided two assists in nine league appearances for Lorient this season, starting the last six games in a row. So he's been deployed out left, through the middle, and as an attacking midfielder this season. And you can tell that his manager, Reggie Lebrun, has real faith in him. For what it's worth, Eli Junior Kroupi became Lorient's youngest ever top-flight goalscorer with his goal against Nantes in September. And the record had previously belonged to a certain André Ayew. He's also the ninth youngest goalscorer in the whole of Ligue 1 in the 21st century. And that record is coincidentally still held by wind-up merchant-in-chief Neil Maupay, who's still winding people up to this day. But anyway, Neil Maupay, still the youngest player to score in Ligue 1 in the 21st century. He scored for Nice when he was just 16 back in December 2012. So yeah, a flurry of nostalgic throwbacks for the listener there. I will put an end to those very shortly, I promise. Anyway, at Lorient, we've spoken previously about how Reggie Lebrun served as the club's academy manager before going on to take charge of the first team. So he's well-versed in the art of nurturing young players, giving them the right amount of game time, trusting them to go out and deliver. And that will naturally be a huge positive for Eli Junior Kroupi's development over the remainder of the season. He's been capped 19 times at youth level for the French national team, scoring 9 goals for the under-17s and 5 goals for the under-16s. But part of me, Michael, does worry that he maybe moves on from Lorient too soon. We've, as you say, got the likes of Barcelona and Real Madrid already circling. And part of me does think that he would really benefit from at least another season or two at Lorient, particularly if Reggie Lebrun is going to continue to be manager at Lorient. I think Lebrun does an excellent job at bringing through those young players, at nurturing them, and yeah, giving them the right amount of game time. Regardless of where Eli Junior Kroupi is playing his football after January and into next season, I think we have every right, Michael, to be excited about just how good he could go on to become. Michael, I think you wanted to add something very quickly on Eli Junior Kroupi.
I must say, I hadn't heard of him before the podcast, and I don't normally do this much, but you got me so excited for him within a few words that I just watched those goals versus Leon. And yeah, like I was about the Cagliari game before, I'd recommend this even higher. I mean, the second goal's pretty good, he scores as well, isn't it? But oh wow, he looks fantastic, doesn't he? Really exciting. And yeah, like you said, definitely see him joining someone in big time soon.
Every so often, Michael, a player does come along that makes you think, wow, this boy's going places. Perhaps we've not seen since Kylian Mbappe came through anyway at Monaco a few years ago now, we've probably not seen someone as exciting as Elie Junior Kroupi. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing how far he can go. And just as an aside, the region of Brittany on the whole has been a seedbed of young talent, with the likes of Rondal Colomwani, Enzo Lefebvre, Leslie Ugochukwu and Eduardo Camavinga all bursting onto the scene playing their football in the northwest of France. So it feels quite apt, actually, that Elie Junior Kroupi is this name on the lips of so many people. He's just this mercurial talent with such a huge ceiling as well. The region on the whole, i.e. the region of Brittany, on the whole is perhaps, from a footballing perspective anyway, one of the most exciting areas in the whole of Europe. So in the top flight alone, you have one of the best fan bases in the country with Nantes. You have Rennes and the financial backing of Francois Pinault, who's one of the richest men in France and the husband of Salma Hayek, let's not forget. You also have some really quite unique stadiums with Lorient Stade Moustoir and Brest Stade Francis Le Blé. So yeah, it's such a great pocket tucked away in the top corner of the country, laced with great clubs and interesting storylines. Anyway, I've digressed slightly there, Michael, but I think it is important to note that context in which Elie Junior Kroupi is, he's absolutely blossoming. Focusing our attention on another player in that Lorient team, you mentioned him in your question that you put to me, Michael, but it would be remiss of us not to also talk about Isaac Toure. So the 20-year-old is apparently the tallest outfield player in Europe at 6'9", and while I've not been able to verify that, his height in itself makes him such a fascinating player to watch. So he joined the club from Marseille, actually, in a 5-year deal on the final day of the summer transfer window. He operates as the left-sided defender in Lorient's back three, just as he did for Auxerre during his positive loan spell there in the second half of last season. And yeah, he's arguably, Michael, the most intriguing defender in the whole league. He flies into tackles. He's naturally at 6'9", very strong in the air. He carries the ball forward with real confidence. And yeah, he has a go in him too. So you might or might not remember, Michael, he popped up in the box for Auxerre against Clermont-Foot last season to curl a beautiful effort past the keeper with the outside of the boot. And he showed real determination to net the decisive goal for his new club, Lorient, in the derby win over Rennes. So, yeah, really exciting player and someone who, when he's on the telly, when Lorient are playing, yeah, you can't help but be fascinated by the way he plays his game. In terms of his underlying numbers, he sits in the 88th percentile for interceptions, the 96th percentile for blocks, and the 92nd percentile for aerial duels won. So he's not perfect. His game is still very raw, but he's clearly a real asset and he's only going to get better. Interestingly enough, just as a further point, Michael, he came through the prestigious youth academy at Le Havre, which has, of course, produced the likes of Paul Pogba, Riyad Mahrez, and Dimitri Payet, to name but three academy graduates. Now, Toure's performance against Rennes was particularly encouraging. Over and above the fact that he netted the winning goal, he registered one key pass, three shots, 10 clearances, three blocks, and three interceptions, and won 5 of his 6 aerial duels. So, yeah, a really, really eye-catching display, Michael. He looked really composed on the ball. He offered so much threat going forward, so much threat at corners and set pieces. And yeah, he also saw more of the ball than any of his Lorient teammates. He's a really exciting player. And yeah, just to reiterate, definitely one to watch out for whenever Lorient are playing on TV. Before we wrap up this section, I do just want to say a few brief words on Rennes. And I think you want to say a couple of words on them as well, Michael. Coming into this season, the suggestion from the club sporting director, Florian Maurice, was that the club should, and indeed would, be aiming to qualify for the Champions League. They're currently 8th in the table, which doesn't sound too horrendous, but they are only 3 points above the relegation playoff spot, and they have only won once since the opening day of the season. So it goes without saying, but that is clearly not the type of form that's going to get you into the Champions League spots. Looking ahead, they travel to league leaders Nice on Sunday before hosting Lyon, who of course currently sit bottom of the table on match day 12. It's not quite panic stations yet for Bruno Genesio's side, but they do need to start picking up points very quickly if they are to secure elite level European football next season. Michael, I think, yeah, you wanted to come in with a couple of words here.
Yeah, just mainly because I had the privilege of seeing them in Wolves' final pre-season game. I can't remember the score. Wolves won quite comfortably, though. I don't think Wolves had gone into that game favourites, it must be said. Ren had just beaten Nottingham Forest 5-0 just a matter of days before. But yeah, despite fielding a really strong team, I was kind of alarmed at the... I know it's pre-season and it's always hard to judge, but I guess a bit of a lack of intensity, a bit of a lack of cohesion with them at the back. But despite that, the one thing that they do have is they've... And I know that you'll probably continue to talk about these players a lot in the future, Ali, but they've got these really exciting young players. You already mentioned Lefay, but, you know, Désiré Doué and his brother Ibrahim Salah, who I think only came on for a bit of a brief cameo. They surely have too much talent to really get themselves in any trouble, I would think. But, you know, Ligue 1 is such a strange division now. It's obviously only 18 teams that gap can suddenly feel a lot smaller to the relegation zone than it once did.
Yeah, Michael, it is a great league. It does have a lot of young talent getting regular game time, and I think that's one of the reasons why certainly recently there's maybe been more respect afforded to the league. I don't feel like we hear the Farmers League label thrown about as much as we perhaps once did. Maybe that's just anecdotal. Perhaps I'm just operating in an echo chamber, but it does feel like there are more people showing more respect to Ligue 1. In any event, turning very, very briefly back to Rennes, they are a great club. They do give us some great storylines to explore on the podcast. And so I will make a promise now to revisit Rennes in more detail later this season. With that, I will draw this episode to a close. I will thank Michael Jones for his time and his contributions. I'll thank Rudy Barwell for his time and his contributions. And I'll thank you, the listener, for all of your ongoing support. See you in another 2 weeks. Until then, stay safe, stay well. Goodbye.